Don't look now, 'cause your 15 minutes are running out. See that good time is getting loosey. Don't look now, fire's out. Welcome to Don't Look Now, the podcast with your hosts, Jenny McDonald and Will Hageman, coming to you every Tuesday with our general stories of, I guess, random interest. I don't know how you want to never know how to categorize what the heck we do here. We talk about weird random stuff. So be that random Victorian inventions, be that, you know, ghosts, goblins, cats, the history of stew. I don't know. All those things are probably going to happen at some point. As always, I got no idea what we're going to talk about because Jenny is our storyteller and, you know, researcher in chief, and I am the random straight man that just, you know, go rolls with the punches, I guess. So I don't know what's about to happen. So Jenny, what's our topic today? Or some hints about our topic, if I can figure it out.
Yeah, you'll probably figure it out pretty quick. We needed a good history of something. And then I was left alone with the television and rotted in it all weekend. So I only listen to a handful of television programs, most of which are true crime based or crime based or mysteries of some sort. So I, of course, got stuck on X-Files today.
Nice.
And I thought, man, you know, all of these government organizations are sure interesting. Who just decided one day?
Yeah.
Who just decided to start this stuff up?
Yep.
What was the reason for this?
And a lot of them are pretty recent.
You know,
your CSA, CIA, NSA, all that sort of stuff are, at least in the history of our country, pretty recent things. So,
right. It's not them.
Ah, okay.
So, not being like very good at giving you guesses, but it's a member of the U.S. intelligence community. It's probably the most recognizable to most people because every state has one.
Every state has one intelligence community. I mean, I don't know if you're going with like, you know, KBI sort of thing or something like that. But yeah, I don't know.
Yes, that is the thing I'm kind of going with, only it's FBI.
All right. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I didn't have a good describe this week's episode. My bad.
All right.
Investigation. All right. The FBI, super fascinating. I ran across a book that tells the supposed reason why it started. So then I like wanted to know the truth about why it started. And here's like the logistics of it, right?
Cool. Yeah.
So we know the Federal Bureau of Investigation is a domestic intelligence and secret security service for the U.S. And it's the principal federal law enforcement agency. So they've got like basic principles that they follow, and their mission is to protect the American people and uphold the Constitution. So the top priorities are protecting the U.S. from terrorist attacks, protect the U.S. against foreign intelligence operations, espionage, and cyber ops, combat significant cyber criminal activity, combat public corruption at all levels, did not know that, protect civil rights, didn't know that either, combat transnational criminal enterprises, combat major white collar crimes, and combat significant violent crime.
All right.
So if you're a fan of The Criminal Minds, you'll be interested in this.
Cool.
So
yeah, I actually have no idea when it got to start. So I am interested to find out.
Interestingly enough, the National Bureau of Criminal Identification was founded in 1896.
Okay.
This provided agencies across the country with information to identify known criminals. Essentially, it was the wanted list, right? And then we got this assassination in 1901 of William McKinley, who was president at the time. And this creates this perception that the U.S. is under threat from anarchists. Seems valid, right?
Yep.
So the Department of Justice and Labor has been kind of keeping track of anarchists for quite a long time. But President Theodore Roosevelt, who steps in, is like, we should probably be paying more attention and should have more power for this. So, like, what do we need to make that happen, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the Justice Department had been tasked with the regulation of interstate commerce since 1887, but they didn't have enough staff. They had made little effort to relieve its staff shortage until the Oregon land fraud scandal at the turn of the 20th century. So President Roosevelt instructs Attorney General Charles Bonaparte to organize an autonomous investigative service that would report only to the Attorney General.
Okay.
So Bonaparte reaches out to people like the Secret Service, personal investigators, you know, who could do this kind of work. And on May 27th of 1908, Congress is like, no, Treasury employees cannot be used by the Justice Department, because they were afraid that they would have a secret police department if they allowed this. And so President Roosevelt was like, I'm gonna do what I want, as presidents are known to do. So he urges Bonaparte to organize a formal Bureau of Investigation, which would have its own special agents, mm-hmm. which is the beginning of the FBI, only at this time it was called the Bureau of Investigation. So it's formally created July 26th of 1908. And using the Department of Justice funds, Bonaparte hires 34 people, some of which are veterans from the Secret Service, to work for the new investigative agency. The first chief, which is now the director, was a man by the name of Stanley Finch. So their first task is to visit and make surveys of all the houses of prostitution.
I got their priorities straight there, yeah.
That's right. Let's go find all
the prostitutes. That's what's truly threatening the government of the United States of America.
Yep, number one priority. Let's go look for sex work. Sounds like a great plan, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And the whole idea was that they were actually trying to enforce the White Slave Traffic Act, or the Mann Act, which was passed June 25th of 1910. Were they successful? I don't have that information. But in 1932, they renamed the Bureau to the United States Bureau of Investigation. So in 1933, they're linked to the Bureau of Prohibition, and then rechristened the Division of Investigation, or the DOI. And then they became independent within the Department of Justice in 1935. And then in 1935 as well, they officially changed the name from Division of Investigation, because DOI gets used by other people, to the Federal Bureau of Investigation.
All right.
Now, this is the time period in which good old J. Edgar Hoover is the FBI director.
Okay.
So J. Edgar Hoover was the FBI director from 1924 to 1972.
Which is just insane.
Right? That's like 50, so it's 48 total, but 50 years essentially.
Mm-hmm.
That is insane. However, he's chiefly responsible for creating the Scientific Crime Detection Lab, or the FBI laboratory, which opened in 1932. And this was part of his journey to professionalize investigations by the government. And of course, he was substantially involved in most major cases and projects that they handled during the time period, because he was a little bit of a micromanager, it sounds like. And he was pretty controversial as a bureau director, especially later in life. And after he died, Congress was like, hey, you know what? We learned a lesson here. Maybe we shouldn't have a little king on top of an empire for 50 years.
Yeah.
So they limit the tenure that you can be a director of the FBI to 10 years. But some of those early investigations that he was involved in included the Osage Indian murders and the war of crime in the 30s. So we've got notorious criminals that did kidnappings, bank robberies, and murders. John Dillinger, Babyface Nelson, Kate Ma Barker, Alvin Creepy Carpus, George Machine Gun Kelly, Bonnie and Clyde. All of those are, you know, pretty notorious people that early FBI worked on.
Yeah.
Other activities that came in the 50s and 60s focused on the scope and influence of the Ku Klux Klan, in which the FBI was evidenced to be working in the Viola Liuzzo lynching case. They also worked with Edwin Atherton to successfully apprehend an entire army of Mexican neo revolutionaries under the leadership of General Enrique Estrada in the mid-20s in San Diego. And Godot Hoover was like pretty forerunner of all the things we've learned now that you need permission to do, but this is why we need permission, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he started the wiretapping in the 1920s during Prohibition to arrest bootleggers. And in 1927, Olmsted versus the U.S., a bootlegger is caught through telephone tapping. And the U.S. Supreme Court rules that FBI wiretaps don't violate the Fourth Amendment as unlawful search and seizure as long as they don't break into the house to do it. Right? But after Prohibition's repealed, Congress passes the Communications Act of 1934, which outlawed non-consensual phone tapping, but did allow bugging. In 1939, another court ruled, however, that due to the 1934 law, evidence the U.S. obtained by phone tapping is inadmissible. They overturned that, and now you can wiretap people as long as you have a warrant. You don't have to warn the people, but you have to have a warrant proving that there's enough reason to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So beginning in the 40s and continuing to the 70s, they're pretty much investigating a lot of cases of espionage against the U.S. and allies. So we've got 8 Nazi agents who'd planned sabotage or operations against the U.S. that were targeted and arrested. 6 were executed under their sentence. I'm pretty sure these are the ones that are in Leavenworth, by the way.
Okay, yeah.
But I'm not positive. Also during this time, a joint U.S.-UK code-breaking effort called the Viola Project. The FBI is heavily involved in this. It breaks Soviet diplomatic and intelligence communication codes. So they're able to read Soviet communications for the first time in a long time. And this effort confirms the existence of Americans working in the United States for the Soviets. So this is during the Red Scare nonsense. Yeah. And I did not know this. So J. Edgar Hoover is behind cracking this code, and he's administering this project. But who doesn't he call? Freaking CIA. So he's just sitting on this landmine of information until the late 50s.
Wonderful.
Right. Another example was the arrest of Soviet spy Rudolf Abel in 57. The discovery of Soviet spies operating in the U.S. motivated Hoover to pursue this longstanding concern with the threat he perceived from the American left, because, you know, if you were siding with the Russians, you were obviously a socialist and a left leaner. I don't know that that's how it works now. But I think that's what they thought at the time.
Yeah, well, if you know, you can watch Oppenheimer sometime if you haven't already, and gets into that quite a bit. So
I haven't watched that. Dang it. Forgot you've seen that recently. The other thing is that in 1939, they start to compile a custodial detention list with the names of those that would be taken into custody in the event of a war with the Axis nations. So these would be internment camps. So a majority of the names on the list belonging to IC community leaders. They built on an existing naval intelligence index that focused heavily on Japanese Americans in Hawaii and the West Coast. But also some German and Italian nationalists found their way onto that list, oddly enough. And then in December of 1941, the head of the Honolulu office gets permission to start detaining people on the list while bombs are still falling over Pearl Harbor. Jeez. So they start doing mass arrests without warrants. And this began a few hours right after the attack because they were in a total panic. And within about a week, 5,500 people were taken into FBI custody. On February 19th of 1942, Franklin Roosevelt issued the Executive Order 9066, which authorized the removal of Japanese Americans from the West Coast. So Hoover, of course, opposes the mass removal and confinement of people, but Roosevelt prevails in the long run. The vast majority went along with these orders, but in a handful of cases where Japanese Americans refused to obey these military regulations, the FBI would then have to arrest them. It's not something they really wanted to do, but they did it. And the Bureau continued surveillance on the Japanese Americans throughout the war, conducting background checks on people who were outside of the resettlement camps and those that were entering. and they would groom informants to monitor and look for troublemakers. Yeah. Afterward, mm-hmm. the FBI was assigned to protect those exact same people that they had helped inter as they returned to hostile white communities. Ridiculous.
Mess.
And then there's a whole, and I'm not going to go into this one too much because it just is super frustrating, but it's worth noting. In April of 1950, J. Edgar Hoover forwarded to the White House, to the U.S. Civil Service Commission, and to various branches of the armed services, a list of allegedly 393 federal employees who had been arrested in D.C. since 1947 on charges of sexual irregularities. So essentially, it was a whole program to purge people that were allegedly gay from any position in the federal government. So it didn't matter what you did, but they were trying to get you out of there. And they got an executive order to do this and made being homosexual illegal in the federal government, essentially. So that lasted for way longer than it should have. And in 1977 through 1978, about 300,000 pages of names were collected that were from between 1930 and the mid-70s. So they had 300,000 pages of names collected during this time period. And the FBI officials destroyed all that, hopefully. That doesn't exist somewhere anymore. Also, my God, that would be a lot of work these days. Also, in the 50s and 60s, there's an increasing concern about the influence of civil rights leaders. So you've got Hoover sending open letters denouncing Dr. T.R.M. Howard, who is a civil rights leader in Mississippi, who criticized the FBI's for their inaction with George Lee and Emmett Till. And they had a lot of controversial domestic surveillance going on during this period of time, used to investigate and disrupt activities of dissident political organizations, both militant and nonviolent. They targeted the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, including Dr. Martin Luther King.
Yeah.
So, because they heavily investigated Dr. Martin Luther King. He criticized the Bureau for insufficient action to terrorism by white supremacists, and Hoover called him a notorious liar. So that's a great note for him, right?
Yeah.
And then in 1971, we have a residential office of an FBI agent in Pennsylvania. It's burglarized by citizens commissioned to investigate the FBI. So they end up stealing a bunch of files and distribute them to newspapers, including the Harvard Crimson. And this is where they detail that, like, local surveillance unit.
Yeah.
And so they have a lot of investigations, though, into the lives of ordinary people who don't really have a lot of, like, political maneuvering, including a student group at a Pennsylvania military college and the daughter of Congressman Harry Reese of Wisconsin. And everybody is, like, very surprised in the country when these revelations come out. Members of Congress start denouncing it. House majority leaders, like, pissed off about it. And allegedly, some of the members of Congress allegedly had their phones tapped.
Yeah.
And they could justify it as long as they had a warrant, right?
Yeah. Yeah, this is that time frame when J. Edgar Hoover just keeps getting weirder. And
more and more radical.
Yeah.
Because he had unlimited power. Everybody just agreed with him.
Yep.
That's not corrupt at all, right?
Never.
And then, of course, when President Kennedy is shot, jurisdiction falls to the local police departments until Lyndon B. Johnson's like, no, the FBI should be looking into this. This is a pretty big deal. It involves a lot of things. And this was the point to which the FBI got very clear roles and responsibilities for investigation of homicides of federal officials. Okay. So Congress passed a law to include deaths of federal officials by homicide with it, that it's now within federal jurisdiction versus local.
Okay.
Because there's always a lot of jurisdictional meandering when the feds get involved. And then we get more organized crime in the 50s. So there's a ton of it, and the FBI creates the Top Hoodlum Program. He seems terrible.
America's top hoodlum. All right.
Great.
Yeah.
So the national office basically is like, everybody go get information on mobsters in your area and report regularly about everything so we can have a centralized collection of intelligence on racketeers. And that's when RICO takes effect. And now I wrote down what RICO means this time.
All right.
Racketeer influenced and corrupt organizations.
Nice.
So FBI begins investigating former prohibition organized groups because they are immediately who they want to arrest anyway. So why not go exactly where we want, right? We basically designed this law so we could go back to the people we wanted then that we couldn't catch for those reasons.
Yeah.
All FBI works undercover from within the organizations, and they're utilizing provisions within the RICO Act to be able to do that. And gradually, they do dismantle a lot of groups, although initially Hoover denied the existence of a national crime syndicate. The Bureau later conducts operations against a known organized crime syndicate and families headed by Gianca and John Gotti. So we still use RICO pretty recently in the news for a lot of organized crime and other things that fall under that provision. In 2003, Congressional Committee said that the FBI's organized crime informant program was one of the greatest failures in the history of federal law enforcement because they allowed people to be convicted of a gangland murder in order to protect an FBI informant. So three men were sentenced to death, which was later reduced to life in prison, and the fourth was sentenced to life in prison. Two of the four men died in prison after serving 30 years. The other two were released after serving much more.
Yeah.
And in 2007, a district judge in Boston found the Bureau helped to convict the four men using false witness statements from a mobster. So they were ordered to pay $100 million in damages to the four defendants that were still in jail.
Yep. And this relates right back to our whole Whitey Bulger episode where he was nominally acting as an informant. So they were doing everything, keeping him on the street and letting him do whatever. So,
right. Yeah. And then we get to the 80s. And in the 80s, they started to have a lot of elite groups for the Olympics to help combat terrorism on U.S. soil and major crime. And this is because in 1972 in Munich, there were terrorists who murdered Israeli athletes.
Mm-hmm.
So they really were trying to make sure that that wasn't going to be a thing on U.S. soil. In 84 was also when the computer analysis and response team started, which pretty sure is just the lab now. Like, you know. Then let's see. I'm trying to see if there's some, I don't need to read all of these. There's a ton of them. Between 93 and 96, the FBI increased counterterrorism following the first 93 World Trade Center bombing in New York City and then the 95 Oklahoma City bombing and the arrest of the Unabomber in 96. They had a lot of technological innovation in the FBI lab at this time. So this is how they were able to ensure cases were successfully prosecuted. However, Ruby Ridge and Waco, which were massive shootouts, had been obstructed by agents within the Bureau. And so that was kind of like a downside to the 90s for them because they screwed up there.
Yeah.
And then in 96 in Atlanta, Georgia, in the Summer Olympics, the FBI was criticized for investigations of the Olympic Park bombing. They settled a dispute with Rachel Jewell, who was a private security guard at the venue, along with media organizations in regards to leaking his name during the investigation. And he was wrongly accused of being the suspect for the bombing.
Hmm.
So they did some dirty work for a while. FBI did a huge technological upgrade in 98. And part of that was the direct result of the HIPAA Act, the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, and the Economic Espionage Act. So they helped the Computer Investigations Group, then became the National Infrastructure Protection Center to deal with increased related internet problems, computer viruses, worms, and other things. And at this point, FBI increased electronic surveillance and public safety across the nation and adapted telecommunication advancements. So that's good.
Yep.
But then September 11th happens, and there's an agent who's killed during rescue attempts to help rescue personnel in the South Tower. He stayed when it collapsed. Within a few months, the FBI director, Robert Mueller, who had been sworn in a week before, re-engineered all of the FBI structure and operations. He made countering every federal crime a top priority, including the prevention of terrorism, counter foreign intelligence ops, addressing cybersecurity and other high-tech crime, protecting civil rights, combating public corruption. So he's the one that made that big list that I read at the beginning, right?
Okay.
So yeah, the final report on 9/11 Commission stated the FBI and CIA were both partially to blame for not pursuing intelligence reports that could have prevented. The most damning assessment was that the country had not been well served by either agency, and they had a huge list of recommendations for the FBI. FBI did most of them, including new oversight by the director of the National Intelligence, but some people still claim that the FBI were resisting meaningful changes.
Yeah.
Let's see. For over 40 years, the crime lab in Quantico believed that lead alloys used in bullets had a unique chemical signature. So this is really interesting. So they're analyzing bullets with the goal of matching them chemically so that not only did a single batch of ammunition coming out of a factory, but they could trace it, they thought, to a single box of bullets, right?
That seems a little wacko, but sure.
Yeah. Well, you know, they thought a lot of things in forensic science, like splatter analysis was a big thing for a long time, and it's now come out basically as being bullshit. But the National Academy of Sciences conducted an 18-month independent review of bullet lead analysis, and they were like, here's the thing. Your model is a little bit flawed, and by a little bit, I mean deeply flawed. And bullet fragments can be matched to a box of ammunition, kind of, but it's really misleading under the rules of evidence. So they stopped pursuing lead bullet analysis.
Yeah.
And they did an investigation 2 years later, and they agreed to identify, review, and release all cases in which people were prosecuted and faulty testimony would have been given. So that's good. I do know that there have been several people released after the blood spatter analysis was proven to be a little wackadoo.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, we do know that an FBI informant participated in the January 6th riots on DC and testified in support of the Proud Boys, who were part of the plot. So revelations about the informant raised questions about intelligence failures by the FBI prior to that. And the FBI's response to this violence was woefully inadequate. And they're pretty certain that the FBI has turned a blind eye towards right-wing extremists while disseminating conspiracy theories on the origin of COVID.
Nice.
So yeah. These articles are not nice to the FBI. Just not. So let's go down a rabbit hole, right?
Yep.
So we already said J. Edgar Hoover is the longest running FBI director. He landed his first job with the Department of Justice in 1917 at just 22 years old. And by 1924, he's the head of the FBI.
That's really young.
That's a quick jump there, buddy boy.
Yeah, yeah.
So when he had died at the age of 77, he spent 62% of his life as the head of the FBI.
That is odd.
Is that not the weirdest thought about how long he's been doing one job?
Well, yeah, and it seems especially odd because, I mean, the FBI is run by the Department of Justice. The people running the Department of Justice switch every time there's a new president, so it just seems so weird that Hoover managed to insulate himself so well that, like, new administrations couldn't get rid of him, you know?
They loved him, I guess.
Yeah, or he had enough power, they couldn't do anything about it. It sounds like he just basically dug up dirt and blackmailed people and did whatever he could to stay in charge. But...
If you're on the most wanted list from the FBI, you can only get removed if you capture, die, or the charges are dropped against you. So this FBI's 10 most wanted fugitives publicly became a campaign in 1950 when a reporter asked the agency for names and descriptions of the toughest guy or their inventory of targets.
Mm-hmm.
And this resulted in an article that got so much attention that they started making it an official list. And since they started this list, 465 of the 494 criminals who made the top 10 list were apprehended or located.
Nice.
It's a pretty good ROI, man. It's like America's Most Wanted. They have a pretty good ROI.
Cool.
Now, interestingly enough, J. Edgar Hoover, who was not at all odd or had strong opinions about things.
Yeah.
In the 1920s, there were three women that served as FBI agents. None were hired during the tenure of J. Edgar Hoover, who reportedly required all female employees to wear skirts or dresses and prohibited them from smoking at their desks, something men could do. Basically, like the day after he died, they did bring in some women, a Marine Corps lieutenant by the name of Susan Lynn Rowley and Joanna Pierce, a former nun. And I love that for her. I hope she lived her best life as an FBI agent.
That's a change for sure.
Right. The Bureau had one of the world's first art theft units. So in 2004, a team was tasked with solving a particular type of crime, art theft. The members learned skills such as how to identify fakes and have recovered over 2,600 stolen items worth about $150 million.
Nice.
Yeah. I'm really interested in art theft as topics just in general, so I always find those fascinating. And then finally, during the 1960s, analysis at the FBI's cutting-edge laboratory spent 2 years, investigating the lyrics of the Kingsmen's hit song, Louie Louie.
I've heard about this.
So apparently there was a rumor that the catchy but poorly recorded tune's garbled verses contained pornographic language, which concerned parents, of course, right to the government, expressing their outrage. So the FBI responded by subjecting various versions of the song to rigorous audio tests, and there's a 120-page report out there somewhere that says that the song is unintelligible no matter what speed they turn it on.
Maybe that's when we need to...
story of the FBI, Will.
Yeah, I was just thinking now you need to unleash, you know, AI on deciphering the lyrics of Louie Louie. There you go.
I don't trust AI. You can do that. I feel like it'll infiltrate me. So if you could just handle that.
That'll work. But yeah, you know, it's cool. Yeah, I mean, I really didn't know much of anything about where the FBI got to start. So
I think
I did not know that basically kind of your prohibition era sort of stuff, like where you have your G-Man and all that stuff, is really when it really actually became the FBI, and that, you know, it had been bouncing around under other names before then and stuff. So
it's important to know where things like this start, especially as they blow up and go weird over time.
Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes meander in terms of what they're doing.
Yeah. I have to say that I'm sure that part of that goes towards their leadership as well, though. Anytime you bring in a new leader, they always want to do a big shakeup, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Well, cool. Well, thanks for the story. That's pretty awesome. So now I know more. But, yeah, thank you everybody for listening this week. You know, as always, rate, subscribe, review, tell your friends about our podcast, and yeah, we'll catch you all in a week. Bye, folks.